In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress on the road, but didn't want to leave you high and dry, so we've got a brand new episode with Fred Van Lente. That's right, Fred is an awesome Marvel writer. He's been doing great stuff along with Greg Pak, working on things like The Incredible Hulk and The Incredible Hercules series. The team rejoins for a new Herc series that starts in April. We talked to Fred about that in addition to another series that he and Greg Pak are firing up, and that is Alpha Flight, also coming up later this year. Fred is in the midst of a new Power Man and Iron Fist miniseries, and the latest issue of Comic Book Comics, his wonderful history of the comics, with Ryan Dunleavy, issue 5, just came out in the last couple weeks. We're going to be talking about that, and also some things that Fred will be doing for Word Balloon at C2E2. In fact, this episode is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, coming back to downtown Chicago in just a week. That's right, next weekend, the 18th through the 20th, at McCormick Place. Now, it's going to be on the west end of McCormick Place in a fan-friendly setup. I think you're going to enjoy it, and really, look at this lineup. Some of the people coming to C2E2, Patton Oswalt, and in fact, a full slate of comedians from Comedy Death Ray Radio will be there. Elijah Dushku, the cast from True Blood, cast members from Battlestar Galactica and The Walking Dead. You'll see a cast reunion of the TV show The Middleman. Remember that fine Javier Grillo-Marsh comic book, a great ABC TV show? The cast is coming back at C2E2. In addition to comic creators like Adam Hughes, Brian Bendis, Matt Fraction, Gene Ha, Scott Snyder, Paul Cornell, so many more. Don't forget, if you get your tickets before Monday, March 14th, you can get the entire weekend for just $50. It's a great savings. But that's only until Monday, the 14th, and then you're going to have to deal with the on-site ticket price. Still a great value, a good time. It looks like there's going to be a great slate of entertainment. Rows and rows of Artist Alley. Last year was one of the biggest Artist Alleys I ever saw at a convention. You're going to see an equal amount of great people at C2E2 this year, and it's just 7 days away. March 18th through the 20th, McCormick Place, downtown Chicago. For more details, check out their website, c2e2.com. Well, Fred, I'm glad you're on for a long one. We've had lovely conversations at conventions, and I'm always touting Comic Book Comics and how much I love it when I see you and Ryan. But you got a big slate of books currently, some cool things coming up, and also some outside of comics media that's coming up this summer that you've got a connection to. So we got a lot to talk about. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I want to start with some of the stuff that's currently out, like Power Man and Iron Fist coming out of Shadowland. You created this new Power Man character. What was your thoughts on coming up with this version of Power Man?
The initial sort of mandate for Marvel was to have it be a younger guy. And they tapped me because of the relationship between Hercules and Amadeus Cho and Incredible Hercules. I got the phone call to do it while I was actually vacationing with my wife on Hawaii. I was in Kauai, and they go... And I get the phone call while she's shopping, and so I had something to do while she was shopping. And they go, well, we want it to be a young kid to be Power Man. And I was like, oh, okay, awesome. So I went home and I drew up this sketch or wrote a sketch about a kid, a teenager who has these chi powers, and I turned it in. And they're like, great, great, great. They had Mahmoud Asrar design it, and he did a wonderful job. And really, that's kind of what excited everybody, and me too, was to see how Mahmoud really integrated that old Cage escape artist Times Square outfit. Like, even had the color scheme was the same. He even had the chains involved. It was really awesome. And I turned it in, and they go, well, why is he so old? And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he goes, well, remember when I called you, I told you that that he was supposed to be a student in Iron Fist's dojo. And I hadn't read the issues of Immortal Iron Fist with the dojo in it. And when I did, I saw the kids were 8 years old. And I was like, and they're like, yeah, it'll be funny. It's an 8-year-old running around saying, I'm Power Man, I'm Power Man. And I was like, no.
I agree. No, I think you chose wisely. Exactly. And especially with what's going on across the street and stuff like that, people might misinterpret it as, you know, hey, this is our Damian or whatever.
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah. That was part of their thinking. I don't know. But, you know, I felt like he needed to be older just because our readership is older than that. And I just wanted more of a teen dynamic. I wanted somebody a little more headstrong. And I just like the idea of a brass kid who explodes stuff when he punches it. Folks, particularly Marvel and outside, have really seemed to glom onto the character, which is awesome.
Yeah, you're on the second issue of this 5-issue miniseries, and again, the initial story happened during Shadowland, but I think it's cool expanding on the idea of the Chi, and obviously the two of them tapping into that same power source and having a different way of it coming out.
Yeah, I mean, I the first series was I read all the old Luke Cage, Hero Fire stuff, which I thought was wonderful. And then I read – and that was sort of what informed the Shadowland series. And now I went and read all of the Power Man and Iron Fist stuff for Power Man and Iron Fist. And so I was really inspired by what Joe Duffy and Cary Gamble did on their run on the title with all these nutty characters, and the fact it was more of a Baco kind of, you know, 80s buddy comedy. I kept thinking like Riptide. All they needed was like a nerd and a robot.
No, but this is great. I think you've tapped
into that. They should have lived in a yacht, you know, off of Chelsea Piers or something.
Riptide. Awesome. But you know, as a fan of the original Power Man and Iron Fist, I think you are tapping into that vibe. And it has that Heroes for Hire feel to it, original Heroes for Hire. And, you know, I was nervous because I'm like, there's nothing wrong with Luke Cage. Do we need another Power Man? But, you know, Victor's turned out to be a very cool little character. So I think that's cool.
I think the general idea with Marvel was that Luke Cage was, you know, they sort of brought Luke Cage back to his roots, which is he only turned into Power Man to goose sales like 2 years or 3 years or however long it was into his title, mm-hmm. you know. And so with that Power Man name just kind of floating there, they thought they'd give it to somebody else, you know. And I think that's that was a really fun idea, and hopefully we're going to see more of Vic.
And I love the Commedia del Morte in the miniseries. Yeah, that's really fun. And I know your theater background as well, so I think it's really neat that you were able to pull this in a very visual way. But that's awesome. I like the characters. So explain the baddies that are happening in Power Man and Iron Fist right now.
Right, the Commedia del Morte, which is a play on Commedia dell'arte, which is for you non theater nerds out there. Is a form of theater that was popular in Europe in the 18th century on up, where everyone sort of plays stock characters. They're almost like I almost think of them as like marionettes, but played by real people in terms of they all have these stock roles. And of course, because this is the Marvel Universe, the Commedia del Morte, are all evil badass supervillains. And we learn their mystic origin from in issue 4 and their connection to Marvel's mystic universe.
Very cool. Well, and also they're street performers. Were Commedia dell'arte, weren't they kind of, isn't it like La Dolce Vita?
Yeah, sure.
So
sure.
And that's another thing that I love about it is that this is like Italian street meets Marvel New York street in terms of these baddies kind of showing up. They are urban kind of characters.
Exactly.
And that's what makes it even neater. No, I very clever, man. I think it's a really neat hook, and I think it puts a new spin on the traditional, you know, again, backdrop for Power Man and Iron Fist. So I think that's really neat.
Grazie.
Va bene. Well, anyway, I also – now, going back to Amadeus Joe, because, you know, I'm an ass. I've read here and there some Hulk stuff. I love Planet Hulk. I loved World War Hulk. Things got so huge. So – I know you and Greg Pak have, you know, obviously been co-writing that and Hercules as well. Tell me about Amadeus Cho. Was that both of your characters? Was that your character?
No, it's all Greg. And now I'm totally blanking on the artist he worked with on Amazing Fantasy number 15, which was that big issue where they premiered all these other characters. It was Takahashi, and I can't remember.
Oh, okay. Is it the Spider-Man Loves Mary Jane? No, that's
yes.
not. Is
yes.
it him? Okay.
It was him. Yeah.
Okay, very cool.
And unfortunately, I apologize. I'm blanking on your name.
I am too, man. You're a very good guy, and you're a hell of an artist. We can look him up while we're talking. You talk, I'll look it up.
Sounds good. and Greg and, you know, Greg, and I guess it was a contest in Amazing Fantasy number 15 as to who would get their own series, and Greg won, and Amadeus won, and Greg, you know, still can, I think, at any time legally walk into Marvel and say, you must give me an Amadeus Joe series. But that was Greg's creation, and smartly Greg used him in the big profile book he had, which was Incredible Hulk and World War Hulk, and that led to him being paired up with Hercules when Hercules took over the Hulk's book in 2007.
Outstanding. I see, and I'm talking to Greg in a couple of weeks, so I'll be able to set the record straight and get the deal behind Amadeus. How do you and Greg write together, though? Because you've had these two series that you've written together. Is there another one that you're currently writing, or are you guys now off on your own worlds again?
No, we actually have two series going on simultaneously, which is the first time that's happened. We're doing Herc, which is the all-new,
yes,
incredible Hercules series that is coming out next month. And then we are doing Alpha Flight, which has long been one of my dreams to do at Marvel. So that's very exciting. And that's coming out with a 0.1 in May. And then we're launching the series as a Fear Itself tie-in in June.
Fantastic. All right. Well, you tell me about the process of working with Greg, and then we'll talk about the two books.
Well, you know, neither Greg and I had ever co-written anything before. We were kind of thrown together out of nowhere because his workload was so heavy while doing World War Hulks, or Hulk, sorry, mm-hmm. Hulk's the sequel. And the initial idea was that they were going to do a book called The Renegades that was about the heroes who sided with the Hulk. And they went on adventures, and that was the new Scorpion, who I created in Amazing Fantasy. Amadeus Cho, Hercules, Namora, and Angel. But they decided they were publishing too many team books, and so they decided instead, because they really liked how Greg was writing Herc, that they would have Herc and Amadeus Cho team up. And so I was initially involved with Renegades, I think, because I created the new Scorpion.
Okay.
So then when I started carrying over that series, and it was very rewarding. You know, I got to write mythology for the first time, or an extensive time, and sort of got to tap into my, you know, long love of that. I mean, Greg and I had never covered anything before, and we're not that bright, so we just did literally, like I would write one half and give it to him, and he'd write the other half, and then we'd pass it back and forth between each other and fight until we got something we both liked.
Okay.
That ends up being surprisingly time-consuming. For a long time, what happened was is we would just take individual issues. We would tend to plot it out between each other, but then we would sort of assign issues to each other to just write the whole thing ourselves.
Within the same arc. So you would take –
yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
And then we took whole arcs. Then we took whole miniseries. Now we've actually kind of gone back full circle. But now we're going to try to do it halfsies again.
Interesting. Okay.
But the only thing is we're now writing two series simultaneously. So before, what would happen was is one of us would hand to the other and then have to sit around and wait for the other guy to get back to him. Now, you know, if I write the first half of a Herc, he can write the first half of an Off Flight, and we can switch.
Awesome. Well, that's cool. Who do you think?
Efficient.
Well, it works. I mean, that's what I was going to say. It's a great blend of action and comedy, especially I know the Incredible Herc stuff, and that's why I'm looking forward to the new Herc series as well, because it was a lot of fun. It really was. It was Herc in a different environment, with a different responsibility, having to watch over Amadeus, and it was interesting. It really was. But then again, obviously, as you say, tapping into the familiar world of mythology as well. As a Greek, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Excellent.
It's my people. So no, that's really cool, man. And now this Herc series, though, obviously Herc on his own, much more of an urban kind of setting. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this is sort of a completely different series. It's a sequel that's in itself a completely different series because it's much more violent. It's a lot less lighthearted. It's Herc. Herc was depowered in the climactic arc of Hercules, which was called Chaos War.
Yes.
And so now he's just a regular guy, but he's a regular guy with 3,000 years of fighting experience. He single-handedly invented the mixed martial arts. He's raided the armory of Ares and has stolen all the greatest magical weapons in Greek mythology. So he's come to Brooklyn to get medieval on crime's ass. You know, the two words I keep using to describe the series is urban Conan.
Very cool.
And that's what it is. It's Conan in modern day New York City, slicing and dicing and getting drunk and, you know, hanging out with beautiful women. And getting in trouble.
Well, that's the thing. I think, you know, in all of his iterations, Herc found a way to kind of acclimate himself to modern society pretty easily.
Exactly. He's the most human of gods, and that's sort of what we keep playing up. And now, ironically, what's happened in Herc, the new series, is that he keeps getting prayers from people who worship him, but he's now mortal, but he still is hearing all these cries of people who are being oppressed by the worshippers of Ares in Brooklyn, and so he decides to strap on a sword and just says, screw it, you know, I may not be a god anymore, but I still have these responsibilities, and, you know, he goes to town and starts kicking ass.
That's fantastic. Very cool. Excellent. Who's your artist on this series?
A great Briton by the name of Neil Edwards, who did Fantastic Four with Jonathan Hickman.
Yes.
And most recently did Warriors 3 with Bill Willingham.
Oh, fantastic. That's very cool. No, I've enjoyed watching Neil's art grow. And I you know, based on the promotional art that we've seen for Herc so far, it looks fantastic. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I am psyched.
Excellent. And now Alpha Flight. Who's your artist on Alpha Flight with Greg?
Ontario's own Dale Eaglesham.
Indeed. Okay, fine. Wow, interesting. Okay, so he's back on a team book now after taking the break from Jonathan and Fantastic Four and doing the Steve Rogers miniseries.
Yep, he's very psyched. He's doing some great redesigns, but mostly this is sort of the classic team. Also, as a result of Chaos War, the folks that Bendis knocked off into Avengers have come back to life. And
among them?
He's already tweeted that he's going to kill them off again, off panel.
So are these like Carnage? Who are the people that he's killed off in Avengers? Are they Avenger members? So which Avenger members? Oh, of course, like Jack of Hearts and people like that.
No. No. John killed off, Brian killed off Alpha Flight in New Avengers.
Oh, I see. Well, of course, yes.
So that's they've been languishing in the underworld this whole time. So we brought them back.
Outstanding. Now, what is the difference, you know, in terms of this iteration of Alpha Flight? What is their new mandate as a team, if there
is
one?
Well, you know, to a certain extent, it is a classic back to basic approach, which, you know, we've all heard this before in comics. But I would point out that the difference with Alpha Flight and that, or at least the difference in doing that with Alpha Flight, is that when John Byrne. Now, I don't know if you're a big fan of the John Byrne series. I was as a kid.
Okay.
And the first thing that Byrne did in Alpha Flight number one is he broke up the team. And each arc and each story was about individual members of the team. We never saw the team together working together as a group. And then they all got killed and messed up and possessed by demons, or some of them were elves. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. And it sort of went in all these different directions. And now each iteration of Alpha Flight has been kind of like, well, let's try and figure out why that didn't work. While our attitude is, it always worked, it's just that we're actually going to do it now, you know, as opposed to, you know, either break up the team or, you know, have them all be Americans, which is something else that you know, that Marvel tried at one point or what have you.
Right. But, was that more Omega Flight? Was that kind of the deal with Omega Flight for?
Yeah, you know, it was a lot of American heroes sort of going north of the border,
right,
to assist Alpha Flight, and it was a great idea. It spun out of the Civil War Initiative concept. Mike Oeming and Scott Collins did a great job with it, but we're getting the band back together, so to speak.
Understood.
That was first assembled in X-Men number 120.
Okay. Well, and I'm sure the Canadians are thrilled to hear that their original team is, you know, getting its own shot now, and as a Canadian team, as a real Canadian team, I guess.
Well, and the high concept of the series, this is part of the Fear Itself tie-in, is that Canada goes fascist, essentially. the Alpha Flight is the...
I just love that, because knowing how tough it is for Canada to even get its own version of Fox News passed, that's awesome.
Right.
So this is good science fiction. I like a fascist Canada. All right, go
on. And as a result of Fear Itself, the government goes very right wing, and really what the series is about is what happens when a government superhero team finds themselves against the very government they work for. And so it's political satire, it's political thriller combined with some kick-ass superhero action.
Now that's very intriguing, Fred. I'm very glad to hear that, because I was not a big Alpha Flight guy. I mean, I appreciated what they represented and was thrilled that Canadians had their own team. Awesome. Go, man. Go. But yeah, it just wasn't my thing back in the day. I was really kind of just a not a big mutant guy. So yeah, what do the mutants do when everybody hates you, I guess? It's true, I know. I'm like that idiot that actually didn't read X-Men comics. I just didn't. I was a Legion guy. I was that nerd that was reading the Legion.
Well, you're still better than me. I was wearing Batman and the Outsiders. So.
I like that too. Hey, oh, come on, man. Jim Aparo.
Yeah, Aparo is one of the unheralded geniuses of this this medium.
I'm with you, man. No, no. Although, you know, it's funny. I talked to Chuck Dixon, and he was telling me at his last couple San Diego appearances that Jim would get standing O's, and absolutely everybody loved him and everything. So I think the real fans knew how awesome Aparo was. Nobody did. Nobody, come on. His own Batman, his own Spectre, Aquaman.
Right. The Spectre stuff, yeah, that was amazing.
Dead Man, of course.
Sure.
No, he's good. No, we like him. But back to you.
KG Beast.
Yes, indeed. Huge fan of the KG Beast. Absolutely, man.
Killed Robin.
And it's funny because I think untrained eyes might compare him to Neil Adams. And even Neil Adams is like, no. Jim Aparo was his own guy. Absolutely. And he goes, I think Jim's Batman was different enough from mine, which was a big thing, I think, for Neil Adams to say. But, you know, pretty cool.
Batman's one of those characters that so many people have drawn him in so many different ways. It'd be hard for us to define, say this guy is the definitive, you know.
Were you ever an artist in terms of, I know you're, you know, you've been writing comics now for about 10 years?
Until I was 10.
Okay.
I did 12 issues of Eagle Man and then I retired.
Eagle Man, that's fantastic.
Because I realized I sucked.
That's all right.
It was a cold, harsh assessment of my total lack of talent.
Oh, we all, I think a lot of 10-year-olds, man, were kind of coming up with their own comics. I think mine was Ultraman. Not knowing about the Ayata Japanese Ultraman of his day.
Their lawyers are contacting you now.
Oh, I'm sure. But moving on. I'm really interested in this digital cap that you're doing right now because it's kind of a neat movie tie-in. Will it be collected in time for the film?
Yes. Well, it will be in comic book form in time.
Okay.
For the film.
All right.
Whether or not it then goes to trade before that, I couldn't tell you, but I don't think so, but it's possible.
How long of an arc is the story? Because you're kind of – are you doing this in like 15 or 10-page increments?
It's 8 11-page increments.
Okay, there you go.
And so that's weekly or biweekly on Comixology and the Marvel app, and then for 99 cents each, and then it'll be collected, I think, May and June. Or when the Dead Tree Media versions, as I like to call them, come out.
Okay. No, well, that's what I was wondering. All right, so will it be like two big issues? Is that like two 44-page issues?
No, it'll be four regular size ones.
Oh, I see. Okay. There you go.
But they're shipping biweekly. Sorry, that important detail.
Oh, okay. That's cool. You know, it's interesting. And again, it's these digital first, then print, versions of these books later. I do find it interesting, and I'll be curious when people like, Dave Gabriel talks about it after the fact and we see how successful some of these projects are. I think back to when the Spider-Woman Motion comic was coming out compared to the print version and stuff.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's an important initiative, and what's awesome is that Marvel Studios is totally behind it, and I've been working with Steven Brassard, Will Pilgrim, and the great guys they over there in production who are actually doing the film itself are all, commenting the scripts and making sure that
it's consistent.
That it's consistent with the way the movie is. I've read the script. It's wonderful. The stills look terrific. There are Nazis, I swear.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah, I don't know. Isn't that funny? Well, and I guess because people saw the Avengers cartoon, so they maybe were a little concerned that maybe Nazis weren't going to show up. Well, that's good. Of course there should be Nazis. And, of course, we got the news last week, Hugo Weaving as the Red Skull. I think that's fantastic.
Yes. No.
Isn't it Hugo Weaving?
It is. It is Hugo Weaving.
All right. I was going to say.
No, he looks terrific. Everybody looks terrific. And what's great is you can learn his origin. Now I have to say this. You can learn his origin in Captain America First Vengeance chapters 3 and 4. 3 is already out, and 4 will be out either next week or the week after that.
Very cool. That's fantastic. And
it's chock full of Nazis.
You got a nice push in USA Today. I thought that was great, too.
That was very cool. It was very cool. It's always good when you can try and tie the, try to get more, new asses in the seats. You know what
sure.
I mean? You know, get people who are curious about the movie coming in and checking out the comics. And Luke Ross's art has been amazing on it. And so is Neil Edwards, her collaborator, did a chapter.
And this is, how is it writing this Captain America as opposed to the, Ultimate Cap or 616 Cap? Do you feel there's much of a difference, especially at this part of his career?
Yes, because the Captain America of most other versions is sort of the Superman of the Marvel Universe in the sense he's the guy all the other heroes look up to, you know. He's sort of the bedrock of, he's sort of the paragon, you know.
Sure.
He's the guy the other heroes want to be. I think Spider-Man is probably constantly asking himself, what would Captain America do? But in this version of Cap, he's just started out. He's raw and green, and he doesn't quite know what he's doing yet. And so there's a wonderful vulnerability to him as a hero at this point in his career that's really fun to write. And what's also cool is that each chapter of First Vengeance focuses on a different member of the cast. So we start out with Captain America, we go to the Red Skull, as you might imagine, but then there are going to be some surprises along the way. And I'll say this. This film, the First Avenger film, is the Marvel movie that most integrates the other Marvel films in a sort of shared universe sense, in the way you'd see it in a comic. And you'll see some characters from some other Marvel franchises popping up unexpectedly.
In your comic, fantastic.
In my comic and in the movie.
Wonderful, that's great. And what's been the feedback so far, fan-wise, as far as the digital property?
It's been wonderful. It's been really great, and people seem to be jazzed about seeing the movie after reading it, which is sort of the idea.
Absolutely. And no, the trailer looked fantastic in the Super Bowl, and I caught the first chapter online, but I wanted to wait and read it collected, frankly. So,
awesome.
I look forward to it, and I think that's great. And you're a nice fit for Captain America. I hope to see you on other iterations of Cap in the future.
That would be fun.
Very cool. I'm looking at my list now. Hold on a minute. There we go. We're doing all right. Now, I want to ask about comic book comics. We're going to do a little bit more at C2E2, but the issue is out, and I do want to acknowledge it on this episode. So let's talk about – is it issue 5?
It is.
It is issue 5. It's the all litigation issue.
It's the all lawsuit issue. It's full of action, 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 legal action.
But it is. It's fun. And, I always give it up to you and Ryan Dunleavy every time I see you guys, because this is truly one of my favorite books. I was late to Action Philosophers, but which was your first, you know, go around in terms of retelling philosophical history in comic book form. Is there any point of that I'm missing as far as Action Philosophers?
No. I have had no previous experience chronicling philosophers in comic book form.
Well, why do you, like, how did that come up? Let's talk about your collaboration with Ryan in general. What brought you guys together, and why this project? Why Action Philosophers?
Ryan and I went to Syracuse University together, and we were both in the comic club. And that's how we met. And that's sort of how I began. I went to school wanting to be a screenwriter, but I ended up piling around with these guys, and it was just neat to see myself, or rather to write scripts for them to draw and then have them bring it to life so wonderfully. And there was an immediacy to that that really made me think, hey, this is what I want to do with my life. We moved together to Brooklyn and were roommates and then weren't. And we were friends but had never worked together until we were both going to the Small Press Expo one year, which is a convention down in Bethesda, Maryland for small press folks.
Okay.
Hence the name. And they used to do an anthology that was a fundraiser for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. So the theme that year was biography. And I had been reading Nietzsche for fun, because, you know, that's what I do, John, in my spare time. And I thought it would be funny the conceit was it was a parody of like a He-Man of the Masses Universe type comic that you got bundled in with your He-Man figure.
Sure.
Except this was if you had a Nietzsche action figure, this would be the Nietzsche comic that would go with it, hence the name Action Philosophers.
Understood.
So Ryan did a great job on the story, and it was immediately rejected by the anthology. But Ryan – and I just kind of forgot about it, but Ryan is a stubborn, stubborn man. And God bless him for it, because he started submitting it all over the place. And he got a bite at this startup magazine called Prophecy. This is in the mid-aughts. This was supposed to be like – this was supposed to be like The Onion, you know, like how The Onion has its features and its AV club. But then it has like advertising from, you know, Chicago if you're in Chicago, or New
sure.
York if you're in New York or whatever. This was supposed to be like this but with comics.
Okay.
And it turns out the editor was a philosophy major, and he really loved it, and he said, this is great, can you do more? So we did a bunch more, and then the magazine promptly went out of business before a single issue came out.
Oh, that's too bad.
And by this point, we had a full comics worth of comics. And so we tried all the various independent publishers, and they all rejected us. And then – but it was Chris Staros from Top Shelf who said, well, why don't you try the Xeric Grant, which is the self-publishing wonderful nonprofit that Peter Laird put some of his turtle bucks to.
Absolutely. A very cool program, and a lot of creators have benefited from that. Go on.
Definitely. And they gave us a grant, and we self-published it. And to our shock and amazement, we were very successful. People want philosophy comics. We thought we'd do a couple issues, you know, burn through our money, and then try and get a book publisher interested. But we did 9 issues. We had to stop at 320 pages of philosophy comics, so we decided this was enough.
It's a nice trade, man. I've seen the trade on your table. Absolutely. And in stores.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's been hugely, that's probably been my single most rewarding so far, experience creating comics is doing that book. But we realized we wanted to keep the sort of we didn't want to do philosophy comics the rest of our natural lives. One thing, we were running out of philosophers at a prodigious rate. But we realized nobody had ever done, the history of comics before as a comic. For that matter, even in prose, folks who write comics nonfiction tend to focus on, because, you know, I think they're primarily fans, tend to focus on very specific things that they're fans of, you know. So you get books about Superman and Mad Magazine and Robert Crumb, but you never get a book about how all three of those things influenced each other. And that's really what Comic Book Comics is supposed to be. It is a pan-discipline history of a medium that, you know, doesn't have these neat divisions between underground and alternative and mainstream and superhero and corporate and all this stuff. All these things feed each other as you get in culture. And really the point of the series is to sort of show that, you know.
Well, I think you achieved that, especially in this current issue. You talk about the Sky Pirates. And that was a very famous underground comic. I'll let people read about it in issue 5. But certainly its influence came from very mainstream comic book beginnings and animation beginnings as well. I'll leave it at that for people who don't know the story. And I suggest they check it out. But really every issue has been like that, as you say. And I think you've provided direct definitions on a lot of subjects that I think due to people not really doing the research and looking the things up, really have only had half the story. I mean, I think your explanation of Lichtenstein was very well done. It was entertaining, but it was pretty clear in terms of how he used his art to create pop art. And I think, you know, you very clearly point out that while it was very popular to the masses, you know, certainly the comic book artists had an issue with it, and you explain why.
Yeah, no, I Lichtenstein sorry, I'm going to start over again.
No problem. Drink, swallow.
I know, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, Lichtenstein's definitely an interesting figure. It's in the issue.
Yeah, I know. I think people should check it out. And I mean, and again, it's just neat to see in the early beginnings. You appreciate how close all of these studios were, and you know, the publishers as well, and the fact that so many of these artists really did go back and forth, as expected during the Depression, kind of grabbing every job they could as freelancers. And I think you do a great job of really kind of explaining the history so far. I mean, again, beyond issue 5 in the lawsuit, the previous issue was the beginnings of the Marvel Age. So we're still in the 60s chronologically. And that's why it was great to see in 5 that you are starting to address the copyright issue. Again, a very complicated issue that – you know, not every creator is under the same copyright rules. And when we hear about these golden and silver age creators coming out with their lawsuits, they're each doing it under very different rules on how lobbyists have managed to change the copyright rules, including its current iteration, which, you know, I love the fact that you guys point out that it is the Sonny Bono Act that gave us the current copyright law. And Sonny is represented in Comic Book Comics as well he should be.
Yes, Ryan is a master caricaturist. Yeah, you know, I mean, for folks I should say, you know, the fifth issue is, as you say, the all lawsuit issue, which is all about, as the name implies, very famous comic book litigation. And there's few more famous and more important than what the Siegel heirs have been conducting against DC recently with regards to the rights to Superman. You know, it is dismaying to sort of see, you know, I don't necessarily expect all the readers to sympathize 100% with the creators, particularly the deceased ones. But I think folks need to understand that a lot of times what these heirs are doing are simply enacting their legal rights, you know.
Sure.
And it was this 1909 law that is applies directly to Superman that gives creators or their heirs the right to terminate copyright agreements and, you know, and try and reclaim some part, you know, or all of them. And I say that only because I've seen a lot of dismaying things from fans online saying things like, well, the Siegels signed a contract, they're violating the contract, etc. Well, that's not technically true. For one thing, they can't completely sign away their legal rights, you know.
Right.
And the new law, the 76 law, I believe, allows any a creator to reclaim that copyright regardless of the term, you know, the circumstances in which the original rights were given away. So in a lot of cases, I think the fans being bent out of shape need to be bent out of shape about the law, not people who are exercising their rights under the law, if the law is in fact flawed, which I don't necessarily think it is.
Couldn't agree more. I absolutely agree. And you're right. I mean, that's the thing. These guys, you know, they signed tough deals. And again, as you say, that was the thing about copyright laws. Eventually they, you know, these companies could not hold onto these things in perpetuity. At least that's the way the law is supposed to be. I find it fascinating because I know, first of all, American copyright laws and other countries are all very different. And Western Europe in particular, I've said this before with Paul Cornell. We were talking about how in music in particular, the beginnings of the rock and roll era are now falling under public domain laws in Europe.
Right.
So really those early Sun recordings of Elvis and, you know, Carl Perkins and people like that, they're starting to fall into public domain. And it's very interesting that, you know, not only can an original creator reclaim the rights, but then also you even go for the further step of public domain that anyone can kind of take the material and repackage it in some way. So I think this is very interesting. And I think, again, what like you say, what's happening with the Siegel heirs, the Schuster heirs, and we'll see what happens, you know, with Carmine Infantino. I don't know if his deal is still pressing. I know he was one of the recent creators that was trying to, you know, kind of reclaim some of his rights.
I was not even aware of that.
This was a couple years ago, and it was around that same time, I think, that the first, I think, go-around with Siegel and Schuster in the aughts. But you very clearly point out some of the cases that we've heard about in things like the Comics Journal or in Amazing Heroes back in the 80s and 90s and never knew what you know, the shakeout was. I mean, I knew Joe Simon. I remember right at the end of the 90s and stuff, Joe Simon suddenly, you know, coming back and trying to reclaim the Captain America rights. And as you point out, things were taken care of and settled. And right. Go ahead.
And he did it twice. He did it once in the 60s, and he did it once at the end of the 20th century. And again, because of the way the law is structured, he has every right to do that.
Very cool. No, interesting. And again, you know, I didn't realize and didn't put two and two together that the reason why I think Time Warner is in this hurry to get Superman done by 2012 is because that's the last time they'll be able to do things, at least the way the litigation stands currently, where they don't have to pay the Siegel heirs or the Schuster heirs any additional monies. I think moving forward past 2012, again, the way things stand currently in court, the Siegels and Schuster suddenly have a much bigger piece of the pie than they used to.
Yeah, well, that is mired in a lot of uncertainty right now.
Understood. Well, yeah.
Hard to say.
All right, fair enough. You know, but it is fascinating, and I think you it'll be good for bar bets. I think Comic Book Comics issue 5 will settle a lot of bar bets when people say, "No, I think Marvel owns that now," or vice versa. I think you'll you know, you guys are providing a lot of answers to some of those questions.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why the readers and the public and the creators, you know, should know what the issues are involved in, and it's not black hats versus white hats. I mean, as you know, John, remember the issue, it's not like Siegel and Schuster and Simon are made of, you know, of purity and are as white as the freshly driven snow. You know, I mean, they've made mistakes as well. So I think that we do our best to show both sides of the story, and I think that's what's important.
You know, and I think back to the Sky Pirates too, and just their blunder in not realizing that
the Air Pirates, yeah,
or the Air Pirates. Thank you. That because I guess the Sky Pirates, we're talking about a parody of Disney that you'll read about in issue 5. But and I guess it wasn't Mickey and the Sky Pirates was the original strip, I believe.
Yes,
I think that
right.
was a very famous comic well, strip of Mickey Mouse back in the day.
Well, right, that was a storyline in the newspaper strip.
That's right. Yes, right? Yes. And Air Pirates was this underground attempt to parody the Disney characters, but they really thought that I guess the characters were suddenly in public domain, which is a kind of a crazy thing to think of. You would think in the you know.
One of them did.
Yeah, exactly.
a charismatic leader did.
But it's a great story, and it's a story that I remember following, not knowing the full background of you'd hear the headlines of the lawsuits like every year or so. I remember in the 80s, like reading things like the Comics Journal or Amazing Heroes and stuff like that, having no idea what the actual particulars were.
Well, it's the joy of writing history, right? As opposed to journalism, which is the first draft of history. You know, you have the luxury of being able to look back and say, "Aha, this is the end," and now I can unspool all those events, you know, out from there and make it be a clean narrative. Unfortunately, life and history are not very good at giving us clean narratives while they're happening. So,
but just like good documentaries, I think you've been able to find some tidbits that I don't think are covered in film documentaries of the history of comics and things. I mean, I've really enjoyed the War issue in particular, and I think you spent some time on some stories, some publishers that normally just don't get their due. A lot of the ones that did end up going under in the post-war era, before Wortham even came around, and just that glut of comic books that did hit in the 40s and dried up on their own volition before the Senate committees even got to them.
Fading
out.
Comics were going gangbusters right after the war. The problem was that the superheroes were dying. You know,
right.
they tanked. I think primarily because a lot of those soldiers returning from the front were guys who grew up reading comics and were reading comics a lot overseas. But after seeing actual war fighting firsthand, they didn't particularly want to. Read about the fantasy kiddie version of it, you know?
Absolutely. No, I think that's – and we don't get that sense of the other genres necessarily in some of these recent histories that come out. DC did an excellent job covering their history, and they make allusions to the non-superhero stuff that they did. But it is a pretty big jump right from, man, the superheroes died out. And then in 1954, here comes the Flash. You know, it's like, wait a minute. You guys are publishing a lot of other stuff. And I mean, Simon and Kirby even, you know, create one of the great things that they did, creating romance comics.
Yeah,
you don't necessarily hear about that.
Yeah, and you know, you don't. Another thing you don't really hear enough of is about how the undergrounds and the more alternative stuff, you know, influenced the superhero comics, which they did to a huge degree. You know, I'm not sure Stan Lee would have defied the comics code with those famous issues involving Harry Osborn that was the first time Marvel took the comics code off its covers for two or three issues of Amazing Spider-Man, if there wasn't this groundswell of creativity bubbling up from the underground comic scene, which we know he was aware of because he hired Dennis Kitchen to do a something called Comics Book with an X.
Yep.
For Marvel. Marvel tried to become an underground publisher. And you know, the thing that you read about it and you just go, oh, of course. That really blew me away from being so hugely influenced by Watchmen when I was a teenager was reading Alan Moore talk about how his inspiration for doing Miracle Man was Harvey Kurtzman and Wally Wood's Super Duper Man. You know, he started out wanting to do a parody, a Mad-style parody like the one he had read when he was a kid, but it occurred to him to do something more serious. And a lot of the fascinating stuff about comics is how many franchises, how many genres were created by people taking something seriously that wasn't before. You know, romance comics were essentially inspired by Archie in the sense that Simon and Kirby had been hired to do My Date, which was a Archie ripoff where the genders were switched, so the main character was a girl and her two love interests were guys. That bombed, but Simon got the idea to do a straight, quote-unquote, version of that, and that became Young Romance, which was one of the hugest hits of the late 40s, if not the biggest hit of the late 40s in comics.
Very cool. And also another Archie derivative that I had no idea about. I knew that Patsy Walker was a teenage book, but having never really seen what her original look was, I didn't know until I read in Comic Book Comics that Timely had not only taken Archie's red hair and given it to a girl, but even that awesome tic-tac-toe design in his hair and gave it to Patsy. And I think Ryan depicts that in a very good scene.
And that information comes from Al Jaffe, the legendary Mad artist who started out at Timely Atlas.
There you go.
So again, you have these different genres feeding each other. You know, it's not just superhero people. You stay in this box, and you non-superhero people stay in this box.
Yeah, and honestly, isn't it interesting when we learn that Joe Orlando made his bones at EC, then goes to DC, and, you know, totally opens things up in the 70s and gives us some of the great lines that didn't last, but every one of those creations ended up, you know, coming back stronger in the 80s to even today, where, you know, that's where Warlord came from. That's where, you know, some of the sword and sandal stuff they experimented with, Claw the Unconquered, for example, crazy stuff like that was all, you know, under the editorial guidance of Joe Orlando. I think that's kind of neat. Or Stan Goldberg and Stan Lee working together in comic strips and in funny books for Marvel. Then Stan, of course, really, you know, makes his imprint over at Archie or makes his bones over there and becomes more famous maybe in comic book circles for his Archie work.
Yep.
Cool stuff, man. This is what you learn in Comic Books Comics, kids. And, you know, Fred and Ryan are going to have their table set up at C2E2. And also go to EvilTwinComics.com. That's their website. If your store isn't getting it, they're in Diamond. And have your store pick up the book because they are incredible. What is the plans in terms of putting collections together?
Well, you know, I don't want to say anything definitive yet. Well, other than yes, we're going to do it. Just because Ryan's got to draw the last issue, and it took him a year and a half to do number 5. So, I don't want to lead anyone along.
What's the end cap for this? Because obviously, you still got decades to go.
Well, John, I've got some bad news for you then.
Uh oh.
6 is the last one.
Ah.
Great.
Well, that's okay. So timeline wise, where are you guys capping things off?
Well, 6 is going to be what we call the future of comics.
Okay.
And the stories are going to be Osamu Tezuka and the birth of Banga.
Awesome.
And it's arrival here in the States. We're going to do a story about the birth of the graphic novel.
Cool.
All the stuff dating back to the mid-19th century that then led up to the graphic novel and whether or not, you know, Will Eisner is often referred to as the father of the graphic novel. We're investigating the full story behind that.
Fantastic.
And we're going to end with a story optimistically titled No More Wednesdays that is about comics retailing and how they can face the challenge of digital distribution and digital piracy.
Very cool. Oh, that's great, man. Well, I'm sorry that the ride's almost over, but I'm equally, you know, understand, and that's great. You guys, you know, you move on to other things. That's good. Poor Ryan.
Always leave them begging for more. That's the first motto of show business.
No, I think that's terrific, man. I honestly, I've really enjoyed this series, and certainly understand that, you know, things come up. Obviously, you're incredibly busy as well, and I'm sure Ryan is. So I'm sure it's tough to get out an independent book like this.
He really isn't, but it's kind of you to say that. It really is.
He can hit you, all right? I want to, you know.
That's true.
He drew a nice Jack Kirby with me. That is, and by the way, that is the one thing that I love about the book, if there is one connective thread as far as a character. I mean, Walt Disney shows up a lot. A lot of these, some of these, you know, character or figures of comics show up a lot. But really, my favorite character has been poor Jack Kirby, who truly is, like, the Charlie Brown basically of this story.
Well, he has such a great look, you know, like a lot of the philosophers, like Ryan loves drawing Arthur Schopenhauer, who you look at him, he just looks like a cartoon character with insane hair and stuff. And Kirby's got that brow and he's got that kind of tough guy, that John Garfield look about him. He's just a perfect comic book character.
And poor Stan, I mean, and that is like my favorite part is, I guess, at the end of, I want to say, the war issue before the Marvel Age starts. And, you know, Stan welcoming Jack back with open arms, and poor Jack just crushed that he is literally like head in his, you know, chest, returning to Stan Lee. All right, fine. Welcome back, Jack.
You know, and it, you know, for Kirby, it was definitely as much, if not more, the crushing defeat of losing Sky Masters. Now, John and I have been talking a lot about titles with the word Sky in it, so I will clarify.
That's a fair point, yes. Sky Masters, a comic strip, go on.
Yes, guys of Kirby's generation grew up wanting to be newspaper cartoonists, because that's what they read, you know, when they were kids.
The pay was better, too. I mean, that's the thing you get, you know, if you're a Milton Caniff and you're literally in hundreds if not thousands of newspapers across the country, you're sitting pretty.
No, and you get what comics in America have always strived for is, which is respectability.
Absolutely.
You know? And, yes. And that was a huge part of it as well. But an adult audience and all the other perks, you know, that could possibly go with it. So in the late 50s, when Kirby was a freelancer for DC, a syndicate approached one of his editors to do a strip called Sky Masters and the Space Force that was about, you know, which is what it sounds like. It was a space opera sort of inspired by, you know, the actual news of the space age going on. Sputnik had just launched and so forth.
Yep.
So Kirby did the strip with Wally Wood as his inker, which, you know, was a dream team if you ever heard one.
You bet.
And Dave Wood wrote it, and Dave Wood is the editor. Now I get confused because there are a lot of Woods. Wally Wood and Dave Wood are not related to each other, by the way.
No, and Dave worked with Kirby on, I want to say, Challenges of the Unknown at DC, correct?
Yes, I believe that is correct. And he was the brother of the editor of Crime Does Not Pay. That was the relationship.
Bob Wood, yes.
Bob Wood's brother, okay.
Wow.
We have gone totally into comics history nerd zone, folks.
It is comic book Kevin Bacon, absolutely, man. I like it.
Feel free to go to the can. When you come back, we will still be talking about this. So, the problem was that the editor, who was Jack Schiff, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. You probably read the story more recently than I have. He demanded a cut as an agent, and Kirby didn't get him the cut, so they ended up suing each other, and Kirby lost. And so, unfortunately, because of this litigation, Kirby couldn't get work at DC anymore, and so he had to freelance elsewhere, and he freelanced to a couple other places, but he ended up primarily working for Marvel, and just because that's, I think, partly where he started his career, that was probably rough for him, but I think more importantly and significantly, he lost the syndicated strip. You know, that was the plum if you were an artist at that era. So that's sort of yet another wrinkle in the tragedy of the Kirby story, which is he almost had that newspaper strip all the other guys wanted, but it got taken away from him.
Yep. No, go on.
And I was going to say, ironically, I'm sure someone else can think of another example. The only person I can think of who ever became mega huge starting out in comics was Walt Kelly. Did Pogo at first for Dell's Animal Comics. Although he was a Disney animator, and Walt actually got him the job, recommended him for the job at Dell, but then he became, you know, super huge doing it through the newspaper strips. But he's really the only guy I can think of who actually achieved the dream of becoming a newspaper strip artist.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, and the only other comparable
thing. Unless you count guys like Bob Kane and Schuster, who all did comic strip versions of their
heroes. Yes, that's true. But I was even going to say Jack Cole hooking up with Hugh Hefner. But again, that's not newspapers. But obviously, potentially reaching a level of respectability working with in magazines, Slicks, as they were known, magazines.
Sure. And then Kurtzman.
And Kurtzman also, absolutely. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think, and it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same as direct money from a newspaper syndicator the way that the Milton Kniffs, the Charles Schulzes, and et cetera were able to do with adventure and comic strips, funny right. strips. So, no, I understand. I really do. I think that whole era is so fascinating. Dell, and I'm so glad you mentioned Dell, because I am learning more and more about their history of late. And Gold Key, and just what they became. And I've got a new appreciation for those books. I mean, I think, and I know you're younger than me, but not that much younger. Us, when we grew up, a lot of TV tie-in comics were crap. And, I think we got it at the end. But Dell, back in the day, not only would get, as you say, a guy like Walt Kelly, who was a Disney designer, but also, they would get real television writers to write Maverick comics, for example. They'd go to the Maverick writers and get a real script writer to write.
They were the biggest comic company in the world for a significant chunk of the early part of the media of the industry, because they had Disney,
right? And it just the licenses, because they had Disney beyond that they were able to later obtain, they treated them well, and they actually got very good artists. And in some cases, not all cases, but in some cases, very good writers too. So you go back and read, even go into the Star Trek stuff of the 60s. Some of the artists they got were just incredible. Some of those Italian artists on those Trek books are really amazing artists when you think about it. Well, I want to ask about Cowboys and Aliens because the movie is coming out, and I think this book had such an interesting pinball ride from when it was announced to being published and now being made into a movie. When did you write the script for Cowboys and Aliens?
I turned in my draft the day before I got married. This year, my wife and I are celebrating our 10th wedding anniversary.
All right, let's all do the math. That would be
so. It's been a while.
Okay.
I think I signed the contract 11 years ago. It's definitely a strange experience because it's something I'm somewhat detached from because it's something that happened at the very beginning of my professional career. Platinum was really the first outfit to pay me to write, which was a huge boon to me and a huge boost to my confidence. The books took a while to get published, but they definitely had a lot of faith in me because they really enjoyed my script for Cowboys and Aliens, and according to them, at least, it jump-started that process in Hollywood because that property had kind of been kicked around a bit for a couple years. Scott Rosenberg came with the idea. He's the head of Platinum Studios, and they had tried a bunch of writers on it, but I think there was something about my approach that just clicked, and it was really cool.
And it was okay. So as you say, Scott came up with the concept. You wrote a script in 2001. Later on, Andrew Foley rewrote that script.
Yes, they brought him in. I found out about that after the fact. What happened was that I had written a script. The bane of Cowboys and Aliens' existence has always been the Wild Wild West, not the TV show, but the film that didn't do very well.
People, the crappy movie, yes.
The folks, I think, were worried that it would be seen as too humorous, and so I had written a script that was, Raiders of the Lost Ark. It had action when it needed action, it had humor when it needed humor. That was my model. I'm not saying it was as good as Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm just saying that was sort of the tone I was going for. But the folks over there, I guess, decided they wanted to take all the humor out of it, and so they hired Andrew to do that. And I didn't see what the final version was until they published it in like 2006 or whatever.
5 years after you had submitted your script.
Yes.
It's going to be very interesting to see what the end result is. It got a great cast. You got Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig. We all want a good popcorn summertime movie. And as a concept, I think, it's a great place to start.
Remember, it's Cowboys and Aliens.
Cowboys and Aliens. Very cool.
It's been an interesting journey. It's been very it's been fun. It's something that I'm very grateful for, at the same time, it's something that happened 10 years ago in terms of my participation, so it is definitely something that I feel kind of distant from.
Well, it sounds interesting, and I hope it turns out to be a good film. And I'm rooting for the film to be an excellent piece of entertainment, and hoping that you'll be able to hold your head high and say, "Yes, I did write Cowboys vs. Aliens. I was one of the writers involved."
I'm highly optimistic.
That's fantastic. So C2E2, I'm glad you and Ryan are coming back. And again, it really gives you guys the opportunity to go check out Action Philosophers Comic Book Comics. Fred has been kind enough, and I believe Ryan will join us to show up at Podcast Alley for a quick segment that we'll record for a later Word Balloon. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific cases in there, and I thought it might be fun to do a live People's Court kind of thing and see if we can gather a cast of singles, if not hundreds or thousands. Look at some of the art with you guys and talk a little bit about, you know, those specific cases, how they all shook out and everything. See what people think. But just awesome. Give – that would be lovely. So fantastic. And seriously, continued success, man. Looking forward to Herc and Alpha Flight and the wrap-up to Digital Cap and whatever's next. And, of course, Power Man and Iron Fist. We still got three more issues of that to get through. So way to go, Fred Van Lente. Keep it up.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It was awesome.
That's Fred Van Lente. Don't forget to look for his Books on the Racks from Marvel and his own Evil Twin Comics imprint with Ryan Dunleavy, Comic Book Comics, issue number 5. And, of course, if you're coming to C2E2, look for Fred and Ryan in Artist Alley, but also check them out at Podcast Alley at the Word Balloon table, and we'll be going over Comic Book Comics. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, coming again next weekend to McCormick Place, downtown Chicago, from the 18th through the 20th. It's going to be a great lineup of guests. I think you won't want to miss some of the great things that are happening at C2E2. One of them is the podcasting panel. It's happening on Friday at 6:30 p.m. Myself, Chris Niesman, and Brian Salazar from Around Comics, friends from iFanboy, 11 o'clock Comics, Raging Bullets, and some of the other podcasts, Comic Geek Speak, all will be represented on the panel. Make sure you stop by and check that out on Friday evening at 6:30. Rick Bayless is coming to cook. Rick has so many restaurants here in Chicago, and there's going to be a fun comics and cooking panel with Rick, C.B. Cebulski, and Ron Richards from iFanboy. You won't want to miss it. Patton Oswalt and Comedy Death Ray Radio are coming, and they're going to be performing live Friday night at C2E2. In addition to great comic guests, all the big publishers are represented. Great guests up and down from Joe Quesada, Matt Fraction, Brian Bendis, Scott Snyder, Paul Cornell, Gene Ha, Jill Thompson, Artin Franco, Mike Norton, Scotty Young, Tim Seeley. Lots of great friends are going to be at Artist Alley. Wonderful people are going to be at their publisher booths as well. It's going to be a great time. It's C2E2. And don't forget, if you get tickets before March 14th, then you can get the entire weekend for just $50. It's a great price. But public transportation, very easy to get to McCormick Place in downtown Chicago through the Metro train or by bus, by the L, by cabs. It's very, very simple. There's good ample parking as well at McCormick Place. So no excuse for you not to come if you're within the area and really around the Midwest. It's really going to be a great show. I hope to see you there. Come to Podcast Alley and the Word Balloon booth and make sure you say hi, because I'll be there and be able to thank you in person for listening to Word Balloon. But join us for all the fun all weekend long, March 18th through the 20th, C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo at McCormick Place. That's coming up next weekend. For more details, visit their website, c2e2.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. As always, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, or at Facebook under my name, John Sutris. And don't forget, the Word Balloon hotline is open. I know we haven't taken calls. I'll tell you what, I'm going to do my best to put some calls on the next episode. But the number is 312-841-7025. 312-841-7025. Call the Word Balloon hotline. Be a part of the show. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2011.